Welcome to another edition of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Bonnie Romilly, LCSW, EMT, and Dr. Stacy Raymond. I'm David Dashinger, and today we'll be speaking with a true icon of emergency services in Connecticut, Deputy Fire Chief and Paramedic Bernie Meehan Jr., about peer support and finding an appropriate clinician in the new emergency services. And we'd like to invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience, where you can catch our new and the past episodes. We'll be covering a lot of topics of interest to responders, including wellness, finding mental health support, EMDR, spirituality, and the challenges of firefighter and responder relationships. So we'll be right back to speak with Bernie right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Romilly, LCSW, EMTB. And we're really excited to talk with Bernie Meehan Jr. today. He is truly an icon of emergency services in Connecticut and a pioneer of sorts. The department where I worked, he was probably one of the first to bring the paramedic program to Fairfield County and to the department. And I think things were very different back in those days, and Bernie will probably touch on that. He's got quite a long storied career. He's been in fire and EMS for 45 years, both in the career side for 35 years and the volunteer as well. He's currently deputy fire chief and an active paramedic, and that's been for the last 38 years. And he's a founding member of the Connecticut CISD team in 1988, and he's a peer helper who trained in both fire and law enforcement disciplines. And I just wanted to set the stage for Bernie. For those that don't know him, our mutual friend Tim Nobes had an anecdote that I think describes Bernie pretty well. He seems to be at all the big ones, and he's a man about town as far as a first responder, always listening, staying aware of what's happening in town, as well as out of town. And as far as a friend, if you were in trouble and he was off duty, he would be there to help. Tim recounts a story where he was a medic at a particular town, and he was responding to a mutual aid call for a multi-car accident. It turned out to be a bank robbery where the suspect police pursuit that ended in a crash. Tim describes it as almost like out of a Hollywood movie, suspect running full speed into the back of a truck, and roughly eight different police agencies there, guns drawn. And he pulls up and he sees money flying everywhere. And then he sees a guy in a high visibility jacket who's attending to the suspect. And it was Bernie. And I think Bernie actually said he was on his way to Walmart, but he passed the store 3 miles prior. So I think that's a good example of Bernie. But he's also been very involved with post-incident stress debriefings, and you know, Tim has been at some of those with Bernie that were very difficult calls, fatal accidents, and other graphic scenes where Bernie comes and has a true concern for those involved, and he's always trying to see that people are getting the help that they need. So, welcome, Bernie. Let's have some fun and learn more about you and your mission. So, Stacy, you want to start off?
Sure. David, I think, you know, we call somebody like that a shit magnet. So I just wanted to, you know, start out by, you know, saying
super,
that.
Super shit magnet.
There you go. So, Bernie, can you just tell us how you got involved in EMS and in fire service? Just give us a little history on that.
Actually, I'm very lucky because I started at a very, very young age. My grandmother's brother was killed in a line of duty in the FDNY. And I heard all these stories from pretty much the moment I was born about the inspector's funeral and her brother was a hook and ladder man and all that. So I knew what I wanted to be since I was probably 3 years old. I became an EMT and a firefighter when I was 16. Actually, before that, I couldn't get certified till I was 16 as an EMT. And it took off from there. And it's really the only job I've ever had. Becoming full-time in EMS when I was, 18, 19, and then became a paramedic at 21 and then got on a career fire service at 22. So I've been doing it forever, but I still like to think of myself as being somewhat young, but that's catching up with me. So, but here I am, 40 something years later, and I'm still standing. It hurts to walk, but I can still walk.
Can you give us a feel, Bernie, for what the culture was like in fire and EMS when you began back in the late 80s?
Oh, sure. We'll go further back to the late 70s. It was okay to be splattered with blood and guts and all that sort of thing. And he didn't really talk about things. He just kind of went out and shrugged it off or went drinking with the guys or whatever. The late 80s is when we got into this. When I realized what peer support was, I spent 4 nights in April 1987 at the building collapse in Bridgeport. And it was a horror show. We were just scraping bodies off pieces of concrete with paint scrapers and so forth. But I was one of the few paramedics. So EMS was making all the recoveries back then at that scene anyway. And I never forget, they had a shrink there, and he actually had a helmet on, a hard hat with a peanut, a walnut, and all this taped to his helmet. Said, "Sight shrink." No one's going to talk to him. So, back then you just suffered silently or became an alcoholic or something. So, at the end of that year, November 87, we took a class at Yale with Jeff Mitchell. He taught the class from Baltimore. He's the father of CISD. And it's pretty cool. It was all new to me, but it rang some bells. And about a dozen of us started the Connecticut CISD team. And some of those people have passed on. Charlie Esposito is one of them, Hamden Fire, and Joanne Supple from St. Vincent's Hospital. But there's a few that are still standing. Me, Ron Clark, retired state police, Charlie Epstein. And we were it in the Northeast. So, we went everywhere from Virginia to Maine to New Hampshire, Vermont. And we did a lot of early things. But it was a secret back then. We swore to secrecy with the calls we went on. But even the debriefings or the one-on-ones we did, they were in, the gun range at the police station where no one could hear us and no one could see us, or on a commuter parking lot or a closed town hall at 2 a.m. so no one would know what we were doing. So it was quite different than it is today than, when they tone it out on the radio, so they're having a debriefing tonight or it's on Facebook. And it was completely secretive when we started this.
So it was pretty much taboo. This was nothing that you would tell anybody about.
No, absolutely not. And you weren't allowed to speak of your feelings. But then we grew and it took off, but it was a big secret. And I would go across the state and on something else and run into somebody I'd been in a debriefing with, and somebody else would say, "How do you know them?" We ran into each other at a conference. Mm-hmm. But it was not something you spoke of. And even the guys at my fire department didn't even know. If I got a call and I got somebody to work for me and I disappeared for 2 days, right. They were like, "We think he's helping those guys up there, but we don't know where he went."
How many would you say that you've done, if you had to take a guess? Not that you've documented
them, yeah, but we don't document anything. Well north of 400 or so. Okay. In my mind, I keep a tally of line of duty deaths, which is maybe just shy of 40. That I went, even to this day, I would say I'm not part of the team anymore. I'd say I'm retired or emeritus or something. But if there's a particularly bad line of duty type call, somebody usually calls it, "Hey, can you go to such and such a city and just help us out?" And I really try to lay low on those because I don't want to be, you know, doing it all the time. I mean, when I first, the first 10 years, I was doing it, you know, probably every week at least. But now it's, you know, by invitation only.
I would imagine, Bernie, it's amazing for you to see what you just described to us about how this was in the 70s and 80s and what it's like today with getting a tone out of a CISC at a headquarters or seeing it on Facebook. I mean, to be able to come that far in that short time, and you've been a part of that history, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I took, through Ron Clark, I helped when we first started. I was for lack of a better term, an adjunct to the state police team, which there's only three of them, and then there was one or two of us. And they actually sent us to a peer helping class in the late 80s. Dr. Wayne Hill, I think was his name, from Texas. And I don't think you could do this today, but it was the peer helper class. The training was based upon your own experiences, which he made you relive. And then the people in the class helped you through it. So it was wild, and I think just about every one of us had a nervous breakdown in the class because you had to speak to something that was, you know, and by then, even after the Bridgeport thing, I, you know, as Stacy said, I'm a shit magnet. I've been beyond my share of critical incidents. So we became peer helpers, and, you know, we would do debriefings, which people know about, but then the peer helping part of it was really taboo. Somebody would call the hotline, which was answered, I think, at the time by the Hamden police. And they'd call and say, hey, you know, we got a guy on a phone from West Belisnia, Connecticut, and he needs some. And I'd call there and you know, maybe the guy was off the rails and there was really nowhere to go with him other than me going out to a commuter parking lot somewhere an hour away and saying, dude, you got to get, you know, handle on things and desperately try to find somebody to help this guy. And we did that for years, you know, up until this became very formalized after Sandy Hook.
So, Bernie, you've seen, probably you could say you've seen two or three generations worth of responders going back to the days when it was taboo to today. So can you say that there's a culture change? And if so, like, how is it now? Is it now second nature to ask for help?
I don't know if it's second nature, Dave, but it's not taboo anymore. You know, I've had these guys from the trauma recovery team into the different fire departments. Previously, I went to many of these fire departments, the career ones anyway, in Connecticut, and spoke about CISD and stress reactions and so forth. But, you know, there's only a few of us. None of us were mental health care professionals, really. I spoke at the EMS conference for a couple of years. But there was really nowhere beyond that, beyond peer helping. And now the new kids, if you will, and even the old guys like us, they know, you know, we can't do it. We can't keep the pace anymore. You know, it was okay in the old days if you had one really bad call and you needed to unload on somebody, but now it's one after the other, after the other. And if you don't dust this off, you're not going to last, which I think you're seeing now is no one staying in EMS at all. And, you know, the fire service has learned and the law enforcement is learning as well that you have to have help. And we now have people like Bonnie and Stacy and a bunch of others that are willing to help us. So, you know, the younger kids that we get, you know, they're in tune with education and help and, you know, they're not as, you know, hardcore as we were way back when. So they know enough to go get some help or ask somebody. It's funny you asked it because I said to one of my guys the other day, I want to set it up in my firehouse. We have 13 of us sitting at dinner, I'm going to have a plant and have one of the young kids just out of the blue say, hey, who would somebody go to for a counselor? And just see what the reaction is. In the old days, they would have thrown them out the window. You know, today, I think they would just like run over in a group hug and say, use mine, you know. But
it's, so it's also been, it's been mandated now for fire service and police to have a peer support team. So that makes it almost, you know, well, it does make it easier because it's been mandated, and every department is supposed to have a peer support team. So, what are your thoughts on that, Bernie?
Mandates don't work. We're supposed to have peer. You know, I was on the committee for the state for the PTSD bill, and you're right, it's mandated. You're supposed to have a plan. You're supposed to have a peer support team. You're supposed to have a coordinator. But COVID disrupted right. The whole process.
Yeah. Yeah.
We haven't had a meeting since like 2 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, but my idea of a peer support teams and what's happening are kind of two different things. And Stacey, you've been with me on a couple of them. I don't think internal peer support teams are the best idea when you have an internal crisis.
Correct.
You know, right. Networking them all together like the state fire union does is a fantastic idea, because you can't, I was always taught early on, you can't peer help your own guys, because I'm never going to get away. If I work with Dave, I'm never going to get away from him. And our the basis of our relationship is going to be this bad call. So while, you know, that's beginning to happen, I think we have a lot of work to do, but we've done a ton of work. And guys, just this week, another one of my lieutenants asked to go to peer helping class to become a peer helper, and I've got a couple already. So, and Stacey, you've been with me at least in two or three that I can think of, right, where we said you need to call two other cities and get some peer helpers in here, because this is way beyond the local ability.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
Can I go back to something you said before, Bernie? You were talking just about putting the plant in and seeing if somebody would volunteer their own therapist. But how important is it for a first responder to find a mental health professional who works with first responders, in your view?
You can't go to one that's not. You just can't. And, you know, I learned that over the years. We might be getting ahead of ourselves, I guess, in the questioning. But It is very, very important. You cannot just walk down Main Street and look for somebody shingling and it says LCSW or psychotherapist or psychologist and say, oh, I'll go see them, that maybe they can help, because they probably can't. If you're not emergency services savvy, you have no business talking to those people.
It is a good time to, you know, you can comment on what has been your experience as far as, you know, just going to a regular therapist compared to one who has experience working with first responders.
Okay, well, I'll back up a step and talk about how I got there. So after the Sandy Hook incident occurred, and I was one of the paramedics that was inside the school, and in the aftermath of that, through my law enforcement friends in Newtown, I wound up at a faith-based counselor. And I was so afraid of vicariously traumatizing this woman that I would not tell her a thing. I wanted to go because I got the stamp on my hand that said, I'm going to see so-and-so. And Dave would say, are you seeing somebody? It was horrible, right? Yeah, it was horrible. But I got the stamp on my hand. I'm seeing somebody. But I never told this person anything because I would have destroyed her. And she had no experience with first responders. And I went there for a couple months. And then she retired. Might have been because of me. But and she handed me off to her friend, a co-worker, counselor. And I went, on her say-so, I went to go visit the second one, who was completely inappropriate. I won't get into the details. It was actually very comical. But her idea of bad and my idea of bad are, way far apart. Mm-hmm. And I left her office literally in hysterics laughing because it was just so inappropriate. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just follow my own path. So then, a month or two later, I ran into a friend at Lime Rock Park, which is my therapy. And he works for the state's attorney's office. And he asked, who are you seeing? Which was, almost getting to be a tiresome question when I ever met people. And I said, that's a funny story, but nobody. I'm done with that. And he didn't like that idea. And I went home that night, and unbeknownst to me, he ratted me out. And I got a call from the Department of Justice EAP coordinator in D.C., and she said, you're going for help. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not. And she gave me a list of counselors, and I vet out everybody. While I'm talking to you guys, I'm seeing what you're all about. And the list she gave me was family counselor this and, they don't know nothing about me. So I called the coordinator back and said, yeah, this isn't going to work. And she called the number one person. Her husband's a fireman. She's really cool. She does the FBI guys. She's cool. So it was Dawn Roy. And I'm not afraid to say who my counselor is. It is Dawn. So I called her up out of a clear blue sky like a lunatic. Listen, my name is Bernie. I'm nuts. I'm not going to listen to your bullshit, but I got to meet with you. And she was like, she was on vacation. Like, okay, whoever this is insane. So a week or two later, I met with her, and I walked in the door. Listen, don't ask me to sign shit. Don't have me releases and all this bullshit. And she was so cool. She's like, okay. So we started talking, and her husband is Jock Roy, who's been on the show. And they had just done their whole fire thing at the fire in Stanford, which my best friend was one of the other captains besides Jock there. So I knew what they had gone through. So I said, okay, she's got some cred. She was involved here. And we hit it off. I could go in there and be Bernie, which is not an easy digestible item. So had to be 6-8 months. I finally went with her to Sandy Hook in my head, which I really have only spoken about to the major crime squad and to her. So she gave me all kinds of different strategies. And from there, we went and helped. She enlisted my help to go find guys like you, Bonnie and Stacy, and mm-hmm. speak at the social worker conventions and in groups at mm-hmm. Fairfield U and various things. And at the same time, I got dragged into the cable world in Connecticut, Connecticut Alliance Benefiting Law Enforcement, which is a law enforcement group, and they adopted me. And they took me to their crisis intervention team class, which mm-hmm. was a week or so long. I was the first fire service guy in Connecticut trained on that. And then they said, oh, you do peer helping? Yep. So I went to their week-long peer helping class. And so there was this parallel network between what I used to do and now this new stuff. And that's where I found Stacy involved with that whole group. And, now I became like with all these law enforcement guys, I started help teach the peer helper class for cable. Then the IAFF got back into the International Association of Firefighters. So I took their peer helper program. And but it's interesting to watch. I guess the point is getting mm-hmm. to where I want to be is watching it all transform from the days when I probably helped a couple hundred people, but you couldn't tell anybody about it. And now it's like, oh, you know, like Dave started, oh, Tim was at these debriefings, Bernie was at, and I've been at debriefings with Stacy, and, you know, you can actually talk about it. I might not say where we were, but mm-hmm. yeah, we were helping. And you know, now there's this unofficial network, if you will, between cable people and IFF people and the state union people and some of the local people. So, you know, like, you know, Stacy and I were involved quite deeply in the last couple of months with another police suicide and a couple years before that with another one. And I'm not a cop, but, you know, hey, you want help? Yeah, get your ass in here and just set up chairs and go get pizza, you know, and that's what it looks like. But mm-hmm. people don't realize, you know, they're peer helpers. So I think my advantage is I've done so many of them. I'm like a chameleon. I can be there and they think, oh, the chief's here. He's getting pizzas for us. But my eyes are open and I'm watching people and I'm telling Stacy, next time he heads for the back deck, just kind of wind up out there with him, you know, and, mm-hmm. and now it's actually pretty cool now because people come to me and I'm no longer a peer per se because I'm a command officer, mm-hmm. but guys come to me and go, hey, can I talk to you? Who should I go to? Yeah, well, go see Bonnie, go see Stacy, go see Dawn, go see somebody. And they go. It's mm-hmm. I'm not ordering them to go. They just want to go talk.
Bernie, that's a great point. And I wanted to ask you a little more about that. And I would open it up to Stacy and Bonnie as well. So if somebody's looking for a therapist who's, you know, a responder-oriented, trauma-trained therapist, what questions or what qualifications does somebody look for to get somebody who's the right fit?
Well, the first thing I would do is, and I kind of coined this phrase in my mind a long time ago, is you've got to find the bridge walker. You know, you know that old, that wooden rope bridge goes across the canyon in the jungle and helps on the other side. And you probably start across that bridge 10 times in your life and you run back because it's safer. So you find Bernie or Dave or somebody up here and you say, I think I need help. And I go, it's on the other side of that bridge. I've gone over 100 times. Follow me. So I don't think it's really a great idea or that easy for your typical first responder to just say, I need help. I'm going to find somebody. It might be easier on Google these days than it was. But mm-hmm. if you find a Bernie or a Dave or a Tim Nobes or, you know, any of these seasoned guys and say, who do you go see? Or who would you suggest I go see? And I would never send anybody to somebody that I didn't vet out myself or I didn't get vetted out by another first responder. And I've told people, I've taken people, hey, look, if you're nervous about going, I'll go with you. Sit in the lobby, sit in the car. Don't worry about it. But what you're seeing now, and I know these two are probably the same thing holds true with them. They're seeing so many first responders that they're high-fiving each other in the lobby on the way out the door and the way in. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. If I went to the counselor and Dave walked out before I did, hey, Dave, how's it going? Cool. It's my turn. So get out of the way. You're getting into my hour here. But you have to make sure that they're vetted out, and it's pretty easy to do these days because there's peer helpers and cable and other organizations, the trauma network, to say, okay, Michael Crouch, we'll pick on Michael from Stanford. He's done a lot of work for first responders. You can see him on YouTube. You can, you know, look him up and people will vouch for him. So if Bernie or Dave or whoever goes to these guys or women, and then it's got to be okay because he's nuts and he's going to them. So I don't have half the problem he has, you know. So I think it's important, though. You have to have a peer to bring you over. If you just mm-hmm. look on Google and again, the other issue, Dave and I talked about it off camera. It annoys the crap out of me when some of these people are doing advertising or podcasts or whatever, and they're touting their work with first responders, and they don't have any time for new clients, or you call their number. Right now, I'm not seeing new clients. Click, take them off the list. You know, if I call I know Stacy or Dawn quite well, or Tabitha on the other side of the state, or Bonnie, if I call and say, hey, you got to help me. I got this guy. He's got some issues. I need somebody mm-hmm. now. Okay, well, they're going to add an hour to their schedule. You know, they're not going to say no. And to me, that's the biggest thing. If you get, well, I could probably fit you in sometime in March. Goodbye. Next on the list.
Well, time is of the essence, right? I mean, if somebody's got the need to reach out, it probably needs to be addressed to ASAP, right?
Yes. It's a 911 call. Right. If a first responder says, I need help, I drop what I'm doing and I go there. If they call me and they say, hey, where are you? I'm in, you know, South Bolivia. Stay there. I'll be there in an hour. And I go there and I'll call one of my, you know, references, referrals, and say, hey, I got this kid. He's a disaster and I'm not letting him go till I hand him off to somebody. And even now it's, you know, they can do a little phone call. Hey, are you warm, safe, and dry? I'm really good at making people warm, safe, and dry. If I got to bring them back to my house and say, you're sitting here until Bonnie's office opens in the morning, that's what you'll do. But make them warm, safe, and dry until somebody can deal with it. We have way too many people killing themselves.
On that note, Bernie, though, when you say, like, all right, this person is a disaster, you and I have had conversations about why is it that first responders, you know, hesitate. They wait too long is what you have said to me. Can you comment mm-hmm. on that? Because clearly there's still a stigma about talking to somebody.
Yeah. And I think it's a mindset in the middle of the Sandy Hook, my mind recovering type of process. I met a religious leader who had been in Rwanda and all these sort of things. And we got very friendly, just as friends. He wasn't counseling me, but we just became friendly. And he said, my comfort zone is chaos. And it was profound to me. And I'm really good at chaos. That's my comfort zone. And I think a lot of first responders are the same way. We're crisis workers. We're emergency service workers. So until it becomes an emergency or a crisis in our head, we're not going to deal with it. You know, it's just another dead baby. I think I'll be okay. You know, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And then the mm-hmm. next dead baby comes along or whatever. And I'm just paraphrasing mm-hmm. here. But, mm-hmm. you know, and then it dawns on me. I walked home and I kicked the dog and I, you know, yelled at my mm-hmm. wife and my kids. And yet, you know what? Guess what, pal? It's a crisis now. So then the wife or the girlfriend or the person's officer or somebody says, hey, dude, you're having a problem. So before it becomes a real problem, get help. Mm-hmm. So then it's become a bigger crisis. Bernie's phone rings or somebody's phone rings said, hey, I don't think I'm having a problem, but everybody else does. Hey, guess what? You're having a problem. And you make that call. It's a mental mindset that mm-hmm. I'm doing okay until it becomes a crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would chime in here as a receiving therapist, and Stacy and I do this, as does everybody on our team. But if we get that call, that is a 911 call from that first responder. And it's because we know that people wait. They wait until they're at an impasse, either at work or in a marriage or with children or within themselves. And we know that it's panic mode. And so that's why, we will see that person immediately and do an assessment and see what they need. And we get to work really fast. So I would say to anyone listening, when you're looking for a therapist as a first responder, that person calls you back right away, that's a huge thing, and they've got your number already.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is, and I've had this conversation with Dawn and Stacy as well at times, this whole online environment scares the crap out of me because I've never done a educational session on stress or PTSD or any of these subjects when somebody in the audience doesn't get dusted up and heads for the door. So it scares the living crap out of me to think that a counselor might talk to a responder via Zoom for, say, the first time before you know what his pulse is, and they get dusted up and click, I'm out of here. How do you ensure their safety? You don't. So, I get the whole COVID thing and all that, but when they call, as you just said, Bonnie, that is an emergency. And likewise, the counselors should have a couple of really strong peer helpers at their fingertips. So when somebody calls Bonnie and says, hey, I saw you on the podcast and I need help and I'm in Cornwall and you can't get there right away and you think there's a problem, you call Bernie or Dave or somebody and say, hey, you need to go up to Cornwall and see this guy and just check his pulse. You know, make sure he can wait till he gets to New Canaan. Because there's way too many of these people doing harm to themselves or even worse, quitting the services, and we lose them and their talents. So it's way better than it used to be that we can talk about this like we are now.
Bernie, you touched on this quite early in the show, and maybe it's a valid question that some responders are going to have. And again, Bonnie and Stacy, being that they are, you know, seasoned therapists in the first responder field, what if somebody's got the kind of concern that if they start unloading this trauma on their therapist, that the therapist is going to somehow crumble and not be able to handle it? Like, is that a valid concern, or how is that actually handled by the therapist?
Well, because we're used to working with first responders, we know how to show them we can handle it, if that makes sense. You know, there are appropriate times to show your emotion to a client, and then there are some times where you do the listening. You know, I'm going to let someone tell their story and meet them where they are. I'm not going to jump in and act like I know what they're about to tell me. So much of it, I believe, for me, is in the listening and validating them while they're telling their story. Because the more you validate and listen, the more they say, okay, she understands what I'm saying. I'm going to take it a little further, or I'm going to divulge a little bit more. And once they see that you're doing that, that's where you build that rapport together. And it's so important. That doesn't mean that a therapist could never show a tear for a client. I mean, we're human. And there are, I think, appropriate times to do that in a clinical setting, especially when you have a good rapport with a client. But seasoned therapists who are used to working with first responders are going to have a higher frustration tolerance themselves, right? And a higher window of tolerance. So because we're used to hearing trauma all day, every day, our threshold is going to be higher too.
I think, Dave, too, those are great points, Bonnie. And I went through this after Sandy Hook about 2 weeks after Jeff Mitchell wound up in my office. He was up here with the state police, popped in when he heard I was working. And he said something very profound. He said, you know, dude, here's the problem. There's really no one in this hemisphere seen what you've seen in this incident. And that was really profound to me. I'm like, okay. And I didn't want to unload, as Bonnie was just talking, on a therapist. And then we actually, with Dawn, we networked and hooked up with two of the counselors from Dunsblane, Scotland, Dunblane. The school shooting over there. And we had met with them and for a couple hours. And it was pretty close to the Sandy Hook situation. And it made me realize, okay, there are some people out there that, you know, can possibly talk about this. They might be in Scotland, but, you know, I found out they're in Connecticut too. But you have to, the counselor has to convince the responder that it's okay. And if it gets too crazy, if this starts to make me think of my children as, you know, the therapist, then we'll back up a little bit. Or maybe there might be a time if somebody sees something really, really, really horrific that maybe that responder needs to see two people, you know, or the counselors, I know they do this, bounce off each other and say, whoa, you know, this is outrageous and I need to debrief myself, you know, Bonnie and maybe call Stacy and debriefs herself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that is a very real concern for some people.
Right.
I think the other thing, too, is I have no problem looking at a first responder and saying, even though I'm a first responder myself, I've never been in that scenario. You know, and I will just say that, you know, I don't try to portray, and I know Stacy, our colleagues, we learned you don't try to portray that you do know what someone is talking about. And I would have no problem in that scenario. No, I've never been to a Sandy Hook as an EMT. So I would tell you that. But that honesty is also how a first responder trusts you.
The other thing too, Dave, which is very important, which we probably wouldn't have brought up, but they're banging on that door, is that these networks that we've all formed, and the, you know, the trauma recovery network and the peer helping network. The other issue is, in my experience, and I know these two, their eyes are going to go, whoop, is when I go to see Counselor Bonnie and say, oh, I'm here because I was on a really bad car crash, and she starts to dig a little bit, and oh, and by the way, you know, I was assaulted as a young child, or I'm an alcoholic, or I've got a drug problem. Okay, well, we happen to know some people at Marworth or Brattleboro Retreat or the station or something, and it's nice to have. If I go see Bonnie and I unload on her about this car crash, and she says, "Hey, you know what, kiddo, you've got a substance abuse problem." Okay, what should I do? Well, let's call our friends at the rehab place and go get you that help. So they're now walking you across the other bridge to further help on your other subject. Or, you know, I had this happening once at a debriefing years ago. I don't even remember what the incident was. It was a bad incident. A child died or something. And one of the EMTs starts talking about how she was sexually assaulted as a child. I'm like, you know, hold on. This is way outside of my area. You got to get those people to these guys who are professionals and can say, okay, we're well versed in that as well. Or I have a friend who's an expert, right. You know, so invaluable to network with guys like this.
It's also, I think once you're tapped into the network of mental health professionals for first responders, they can also help you get appropriate help in other modalities like rehab that are, again, specifically able to handle first responder, you know, that special sort of world that responders are in and their needs. So, you know, I would say that, you know, as a resource, the Fairfield County Trauma Response Team on their website has quite a listing of trauma-informed responder-oriented therapists. If anybody's looking, that's certainly a good resource to use. Bernie, along these lines, probably something else that may pop up for somebody is like insurance. You know, is this going to be covered by my insurance, or I'm a volunteer and I don't have, you know, health insurance per se. What are some of the things you've come across in terms of how people are handling this piece?
Yeah, this is another sore subject with me. Stacy's smiling because she knows, because she listened and she solved a lot of that problem with her practice. But especially full-time public safety people, almost all have insurance, and we're used to going to the doctor, hand them our Cigna card, pay our $50, and we're on our way. A lot of, at least previously, I don't want to generalize as much as I usually do anyway, but previously a lot of the counselors are self-pay, and it doesn't jive with how public safety people go get help. You know, I go get a physical, I'm entitled to a physical, I'm entitled to a pair of glasses a year and all these other things. Well, I'm not shelling out $200 an hour to a counselor, but Stacy, I have another friend who's a medical billing expert, and I set her off on some of these guys, Stacy knows, and they signed up so they can do network in network with the insurance carriers and so forth, because they're just not used to it. And for the volunteers, I know you have a note on your chat here, VFIS, Volunteer Fireman's Insurance Services, most volunteer agencies have some sort of additional insurance provider, and almost all of them have a rider for mental health care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if, again, talk to a seasoned peer or a seasoned officer or seasoned healthcare worker and say, hey, you know what, I can help you out here. You know what? We've got $200,000 from the Lions Club for mental health care. Mm-hmm. We can tap into if you don't have insurance. Or VFIS will cover you for the first 10 visits. Or EAP, if you have that availability and they're in network of sorts. But that shouldn't be, you know, a hurdle. If, right. you know, if somebody came to me and said, you know, let's say a young volunteer who didn't have insurance, I got to go talk to somebody and look, I'll shell out the money myself to get you help if I have to. But everybody here, Bonnie's nodding her head, is willing to help these people. But they shouldn't be doing it for free. This is their profession. So, you know, work with, you know, insurance services, billing agencies that can help, you know, get you paid for what you're doing. This shouldn't be charity work or pro bono
right.
stuff.
Simply ask the clinician, do you offer a sliding scale? And mm-hmm. I know pretty much everybody in Fairfield County Trauma Response Team, you know, if they're not in network, they'll offer a sliding scale mm-hmm. for first responders and in some cases veterans. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and veterans is another one. They should all have insurance, you know, TRICARE mm-hmm. or something. And it's once you figure out how to work with all that, it should never be a hurdle, you know, and mm-hmm. I'd hate to think that somebody won't get help because they can't afford it. That's mm-hmm. absurd.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we wrap up here, let's just look towards the future and the state of affairs today. What would you say today's, you know, fire department or today's typical emergency services organization looks like in terms of not only mental health, but wellness and other modalities that responders are taking advantage of? What are you seeing out there?
I'm seeing it all, and Stacy's smiling because, I mean, I've sent my engine companies to her yoga in the park classes, and we have yoga in the firehouse, and we have a therapeutic masseuse that comes in a massage Mondays at the Danbury Fire Department, you know. So 20 years ago, they literally would have run me out of the building, but now – I literally laugh because we have a 20-by-40-foot gym in my fire station, and there's 12 or 13 guys working and another 12 or 13 guys in the outhouses, and there's not enough room for all their yoga mats in that thing. And
that's you fantastic. Know, I'm
too spastic to do yoga, but these guys are into it. And, you know, I think going forward, you know, OSHA requires us to have a physical every year. Somebody in the very near future is going to require us to have a mental health care dust off annually. You know, you really shouldn't, you know, you go to the doctors now and they say, do you feel safe? Is your home safe? Okay. They should say, okay, you're here for your fire department physical. You know, are you having emotional problems? Well, yeah. Do you have a substance abuse problems? Maybe, I don't know. You know, so I think going forward, all those things, they're out there. It's just not, you know, it hasn't been accepted by, you know, Cigna doesn't have a page for wellness for first responders or Aetna or whoever. You know, they need to bring these people together, and it's all available, but it's somewhat fragmented. I can call Stacy for one thing and Wendy for yoga and this one for massages and that, you know, this one for rehab purposes. But I think as time goes on, I think you'll see the larger, you're seeing it now. I mean, the state police have two people full time kind of doing wellness responses, but you're going to need coordinators to be able to call, you know, one-stop shopping and say, you know, I've got problems with my kids or I have whatever mm-hmm. issues. Who do I go to? Right now, it's a matter of who you know. If you know Bernie, Stacy, mm-hmm. Bonnie, or Dave, we can get you some help. You know, but I think that's where we're heading, and it's good stuff. I mean, guys are dying every day of heart attacks and suicides and mm-hmm. all these sort of things. And you know, there was a fatal fire in Baltimore this morning. It causes critical incident stress. You know, so we need to formalize more of this, but we're way ahead of where we were thanks to guys like you.
My dream one day is to see a mental health professional in every department. So that's what I'm going to hope for in 20 years from now, is that we're not just putting Band-Aids, that we're actually preventing every day with someone embedded in these departments in the future.
Bernie, it's been great. We could probably go on for another hour, and maybe we will sometime. How can people find you out there? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, you can email me, which I think you have the email address to put up. There you go. Anytime, day or night. You can find me on Facebook. And my phone number is on my Facebook page. So if you want my phone number, just call, or just call the Danbury Fire Department and get it. I mean, I'm not that hard to find. Probably if you Googled me, you'd find my phone number. But call. And I almost always answer. If I don't answer, there's some kind of tremendous catastrophe going on. But I'll get back in 20 minutes, you know. But, you know, I think it's very important that everybody find somebody they can call to at least enter the realm of some help, you know. And I want to thank Bonnie and Stacy, especially for really leading the charge around here for helping people, you know, and there's the others, you know, the Dawn, the Michael Crouches, those guys, mm-hmm. Dave, and what you're doing with this podcast is just phenomenal work.
Well, thanks. It also, it's thanks to guests like you who are really able to, you know, be relatable to the rank and file and talk about these subjects that, as we were saying, were taboo not that long ago. So thank you, Bernie, for making that contribution and what you do out there every day. So on behalf of Dr. Stacy Raymond and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW, I'd like to invite everyone to like and subscribe. We are on YouTube Wednesdays live at 7 p.m. at Responder Resilience Channel. We're on the Facebook page, Responder Wellness, Inc., and we are on BBS Radio TV, where you can find us and watch past episodes. I'd like to remind everybody to stay safe and be kind to yourself. Take care.